Hi, Cameron Wilson joining you for Bush Telegraph on RN and Radio Australia. Today, a report that's been a year and a half in the making. Last night, the New South Wales chief scientist released a report into coal seam gas. Now, it's hoped it will go some way to diffusing the debate over land use, so we'll be joined by the chief scientist today. We'll also gauge the reaction from farming communities and resources companies. Also ahead, we'll continue with our focus on conservation. Today, we look at the green parrot of Norfolk Island. It's battling cats and rats, no surprise there, but it's also facing an unusual predator with an appetite for its eggs. We'll tell you more today on Bush Telegraph. Well, traditionally we think of wool and cotton, maybe either leather, as the natural fabrics used in the fashion industry. But now there's a new one. It's coming out of Queensland's University of Technology. A group of students are using fermentation to create a new form of textile for the fashion world. Jessica Hinchcliffe went to QUT to learn more about kombucha.
It's the most amazing project, the ability to actually grow your own textiles. It's an incredible opportunity for QUT and our students to really imagine and re-envisage how apparel could be made. It's early days for it, but it really, I think, has a next leg of potentially how clothing could be produced.
How exciting do you think this project is for QUT, but also for the students as well?
I think first off, it's perhaps not exciting, it's actually scary, because it really is slightly, to use a word, gross. It is slimy, it is thick, it's smelly. So I think the excitement perhaps comes more when the garment or the medium is actually produced. For a project for us, it's hugely exciting from an engagement point of view with students and just reimagining the idea of what textiles, what it could be for making apparel. It's very cool.
When you were first approached with the idea, did you think it was a little zany or it was a little too much science for the fashion world?
Never too zany. I always love when fashion hits science world. Believe it or not, it's actually relatively similar to making a sourdough or homemade ginger beer or even traditional beers for that matter, because it's a yeast medium with sugar and it has a feeder, a culture, and it creates a curd, like a weight on top.
And it's a non-woven, so it actually grows together. The fibres are very, very short, so unlike a usual cotton cellulose fibre, which are, you know, fairly long fibres, these ones are very short, which means it tears easily. But it's stronger than paper because it's actually growing together. It's not compressed together as paper would have been.
Alice, how is it to work with this sort of material or this sort of medium?
Well, it's a bit strange. It's kind of like a cross between paper and leather. And depending on what stage of drying it is, it could be quite gummy, it could be quite hard, it could be quite soft and or almost like tissue paper through to a really thick leather. And for that reason, you can treat it like paper or leather in a number of ways. You can use it for top stitching. You can use it as a bind on fabric, for example. You can cut it into segments and stitch it into modules or panels that work together. And, of course, you can use it just as you would leather in terms of making a full garment if you want. We've been doing experiments with dyeing it, spray painting it. We've dyed it while it's been growing. We've tried growing it in coloured pigments. So, there's a lot you can do with colouring, yeah.
Dean, what are some of the bases that you've started with? I think I saw coffee or tea over there as well.
Yeah, basically the broth needs a medium to eat, which can be things like tea or coffee or red wine, molasses. And wonderfully, each one of those different mediums gives quite a different answer. So we're very early days for exploratory of what it's going to be. I know that coffee will give a slightly different mottliness to it. It's really amazing to think you can use different food to get a different textile medium answer.
We're sitting here at the edge and we're surrounded by jars, and some quite large jars where we can see the kombucha sort of coming to the top, and it's nearly alien-like, isn't it?
Oh, very much so. As I said before, it's actually slightly creepy because it really has a skin quality about it, and it's slightly brown colour, and so it looks very human-like to a degree. It's even quite surprising too, because when you first take it out, it's a very thick medium, often perhaps about an inch or 2-3 centimetres thick. But when it dries down, it becomes micro-thin because a lot of it is actually based on water. So when you dry, which takes only about a week for it to dry, the medium compresses dramatically. And they even put it in the washing machine once they take it out of the medium. That's how strong it is. It's absolutely incredible.
How have you gone with the smell? There is that fermenting sort of smell. Has it been hard to sort of work with that, or you just accept that as part of the process?
I think it's
like brewing beer. you want the end goal, perhaps, so you cope with the process.
That's it, yeah.
And Dean, how do you think this could shape the future of fashion? Because it's rather exciting to think that you could be making a medium that could then be used in certain areas in the future.
Because in traditional clothing industries, about 20% of fabric's wasted. So in a normal fabric, you would actually get a roll, a bolt of fabric, and you know, it's flat, two-dimensional. And to then cut out all the pattern shapes to make a garment, often 20, even 30% of the fabric's wasted. So from a sustainability point of view, that is crazy. So looking at just reinventing how apparel could be made using growing your own forms and shapes, and even the tiniest little bit of wastage on this, you can then slush it back together, you can remould it, you can just keep working with it. It's quite incredible. And we're joking before about it smelling. Of course, the end product doesn't smell. You can seal it and you can make it waterproof. It's very, very strong fibre.
QUT fashion student Alexandria Stokes says it's been fascinating working with a living material.
It's something really experimental, and it's been really interesting to be able to get into the science side of things and learn more about it and do some different things with it, like experiment with the colour and the texture, yeah.
When you tell your friends and family that you're fermenting fabric, so to say, what has been their reaction?
It's a bit surprising, I guess you'd say. No one really understands until you sort of get to touch it and get to play with it and get to smell it, I guess, as well.
Has everyone wanted to get their hands dirty into the tubs and getting
no,
there?
Not at all, actually.
Alexandria Stokes, a QUT fashion student, ending that report from Jessica Hinchcliffe. We've got some pictures of both fermenting kombucha in a jar and also the final product, the textile or the material that looks, to my eye, looks a little like biltong, but that might be underselling it a touch. We'll make sure those pictures are up on our website very soon. You're listening to Bush Telegraph on RN.
The thrill is back.
Now, I got to the Play-Doh little as I understood. It was my first experience of intellectual ecstasy.
On the Philosopher's Zone, the pleasure of Plato.
I was out of my mind. I had to put the book down for a moment to catch my breath.
And why we need him now more than ever.
Beyond the chaos, the notion of a beautiful and good reality.
The new season of the Philosopher's Zone starts Sunday, 5:30 p.m. here on RN.
That's a zombie apocalypse, not something you necessarily would expect to hear on Bush Telegraph. But today we're discussing how a zombie apocalypse might actually help prepare us for natural disaster, floods, fires, cyclone, and more. Now, it's an intriguing idea, and it's a timely one here in Australia. We've had the Met Bureau predict a drier than normal summer season ahead, and we've actually seen an early start to the fire season in Tasmania as well. So how can zombies help us deal with natural disaster? Jenny Gottstein is a game developer from San Francisco, and she's developed a disaster preparedness game that is actually making a bit of a difference. Jenny, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You have to tell me how this idea came about of harnessing people's interest in zombies to improve their disaster preparedness.
Oh, sure. Well, actually, it came about from a conversation with a good friend of mine. We were giggling over a fitness craze that came out of Chicago a few years ago called Zombie Fit, where it was essentially parkour, but there was a zombie narrative where you were training for the zombie apocalypse by jumping off of buildings and throwing heavy objects towards their brains. And we thought that was particularly entertaining. But then we realized in the course of the conversation that we would be absolutely done for in a zombie apocalypse. We would probably be the first to go. And then we started to think, oh, actually, if anything happened in our city, we would probably be toast. So we, being game designers, we thought, man, wouldn't it be interesting if we could create a zombie apocalypse disaster preparedness game where in the course of running away from zombies, you actually learned important skills that would be helpful in any urban emergency. So a few years later, in 2011, we designed the first zombie apocalypse disaster preparedness game in San Francisco. And in the course of playing this game, the players learned important skills related to earthquakes, which is the predominant threat in the Bay Area. And since then, we've been designing games for different threats, wildfires included, to expand this concept of preparing through play.
So can you tell me more about the game? How does it actually work?
Sure. Well, so first of all, I should backtrack. I'm a game producer. I design games for a company called The Go Game. And we design these interactive, high-tech games all around the world. And they're based off of the smartphone technology that we created. So essentially, in the course of the game, you're receiving missions through your cell phone that send you around the real world. So it's not a mobile game. It's not a video game. It's a real-world adventure game through your phone. So in the zombie game, you're receiving missions that send you around the city to complete various challenges. Some of them are super goofy, right? Like zombie brain bashing relays using piñatas. But some of them are super helpful, like learning about evacuation routes or radio stations that you should tune into in an emergency to learn important information, or basic first aid skills. So you're completing around the city as you're being chased by actors that we hired dressed as zombies. And of course, we gave all the players Nerf guns to defend themselves. And the game culminated in a thriller flash mob in a local park. And the winners got what we call go bags, which is essentially emergency kits. And everyone high-fived and went home. So that was the basic zombie.
So in some ways, you're almost marketing, I guess, aren't you? This idea of preparing for disaster and making sure people engage with something that they may ignore otherwise. To what level have authorities got on board and supported what you're doing?
Well, it's interesting. So the first game we just put together for friends and family, and word got out, and people started going crazy over the idea. And in fact, I still get emails to this day. Mind you, the first game was in 2011. And we just put it together based on materials that were already public, you know, Red Cross resources, the local government, you know, our San Francisco has an earthquake website. So we were just pulling things from websites that already exist. But based on the popularity of that first game, the city of San Francisco reached out to us and said, hey, listen, we would love to collaborate on future disaster preparedness games. And based on that, more and more companies, government agencies, community organizations reached out to us to create games to meet different threats and to meet different communities.
So what will you actually incorporate? Will you incorporate in the game things that whether it's the Red Cross or local councils, whatever it might be, firefighters, things that they actually want to train and teach the public about? You'll incorporate that in the game, will you?
Exactly. And going back to your point about it's kind of something like marketing, it's true. You know, all of these ideas, all of these resources already exist, but the problem is the public doesn't really know about them. So by creating a game that's social and that's fun, you bring people to the information that they need to know that they wouldn't arrive at organically, you know, because it's a terrifying subject matter, and B, you know, it's kind of boring to learn it from a checklist. So by making a game, you're marketing this idea of preparedness, or more importantly, resilience, in a way that's fun, that's catchy.
Yeah, it's interesting that you've taken this approach, because every year we have warnings for the fire season for Southern Australia up ahead about how bad it's likely to be. And this year it came out again as normal, warnings that there's a higher than average risk in certain areas. And yet the authorities, one of the things they said is, look, we just find it so hard to get people to engage in these warnings and take them on board. I wonder if you think that the type of initiative you've come up with in San Francisco would actually translate to a rural or a smaller setting rather than a city or urban area, given that a lot of our natural disasters occur outside of the cities.
Sure. Well, actually, I'm from a town of 100 people in California, and wildfires are a huge problem. And so we put together a game in my town that's called Volcano, although volcanoes are not the threat. And we worked with the local fire authorities to disseminate information. And the difference of this game versus an urban game, first of all, you can't use certain technology. In Volcano, there's no cell phone reception, so everything was done on paper. And second of all, when you're preparing a community that's in a rural setting, you have to give people information that will allow them to operate on their own for days, if not weeks. Whereas in an urban setting, you're just trying to give people information about resources that will be available to them within a 5-20 block radius 48 hours after the event. So it is a very different set of skills that you're imparting, but there's interesting ways to disseminate it. So for example, in the wildfire game, we worked with the fire departments, with CAL FIRE, to take information like preparing your home for evacuation. There's actually a couple of important steps you have to take when you leave to make sure that, A, you know, you're buttoning down your home in the most effective way possible, and B, if firefighters need to use your home as a home base, they have all these resources available to them. Mm-hmm. So, for example, you're supposed to put a ladder up against the side of your home so firefighters can easily get to the roof to defend from that position. So we compiled all this information in a water balloon relay. So if people were able to guess the things that they were supposed to do, they were given a water balloon, which they could throw at one of our volunteers who's dressed in a bathing suit running up and down the streets of Volcano. So there's a lot of fun ways to take this information and convert it into something that you will remember if you physically act it out, if you build the muscle memory through a game.
Yeah, so the idea, the principle of engaging people through one of their natural interests to learn about something that they're ignoring but that is important to them applies, whether it's rural, city, and whatever the threat might be. Which brings me to the point that, based on our Facebook feedback, we have a picture of a man who's, how do I describe this? Imagine Big Bird minus Big Bird's head and the bloke's head instead with a partially devoured cheek. I think he's a victim of zombie attack. We have him up on our Facebook page to tell people that you were on today. And we've got a few people that think this is utter rubbish or that I'm offended by this picture. I don't want to look at it. So you clearly need to think beyond just zombies to engage people. There's some portions of the community that aren't interested.
Absolutely. You know, so the original game had a zombie theme, and it definitely brought out a certain slice of the population that think zombies are funny or engaging in some way. But certainly in different communities and in different spaces, you need to use different narratives. So for the larger game that we did for San Francisco, instead of making it about zombies, we made it about, the theme was, we love San Francisco and we've got this. So half of the missions were purely utilitarian. Take a photo of you next to your emergency kit or make a communication plan with your family and friends. And then half of them were simply about celebrating the city. And the reason why that theme was selected is because resilience, especially on a large scale level, is about taking ownership over this idea of we're more prepared than we think. And games can further this idea by creating the sense of pride, the sense of identity around the region as a whole. And when people feel like, oh, I am a representative, I'm an ambassador of the safety, not only of myself, but of my community, it creates this this new paradigm, which is much more effective in recovery as opposed to this idea of fear.
Okay.
So you do have to change the narrative depending on who your audience is.
It just seems to me that it's something that could be done at community level. You don't have to necessarily be a game developer from San Francisco to make this
no.
work.
No, in fact, we encourage everyone to explore this idea of using games and play to communicate these really tough concepts.
Well, Jenny, I want to let you go with a more supportive Facebook comment, if I can. This is this is from Michelle, who's shared quite a bit about her life with us. She says, she enjoyed the picture, likes the idea. My daughter's been preparing me for the zombie apocalypse since she was about 8. Used to test me all the time about what I need to know to survive. Always double tap, wear your seatbelt, never use public restrooms, etc. when I got a new boyfriend, she would assess them on their ability to survive the zombies. She liked my latest, who lives off the grid in the bush and can build planes. He thought he would be very handy. So you've got Michelle on board, if no one else. Jenny, really interesting concept. Thanks for telling us all about it today.
Thank you.
Jenny Gottstein, who's a game developer from San Francisco, with that idea to engage people's interest in zombies in that case, to make sure they're prepared for disaster. You're listening to Bush Telegraph on RN. It's not all about zombies today. I've got Rural News with Tony Allen. Tony's actually going to tell us about a novel approach the citrus industry is taking to try to gain support for its industry, which is, I hadn't considered such an approach before, but we'll hold off on that for a moment. Where should we start, Tony, today?
Yeah, well, not with the living dead. No, start in Queensland. The Queensland government is calling for an immediate halt to fresh ginger imports from Fiji, after live roundworms were found in cartons shipped to Sydney. Now, we've talked about this before. The Queensland ginger industry did not want Fijian imports, claiming it was a quarantine risk. Mm-hmm. But ginger from Fiji first went on sale at the Sydney markets last week. They have now found live roundworms in the cartons. The particular strain of roundworm found already exists in Queensland, but the State Agriculture Minister, John McVeigh, says it is proof that the fumigation requirements on the imported ginger have failed.
And that is confirmation, I'm sad to say, that what we were complaining about with the former federal government has now come to pass, and we're certainly calling on Barnaby Joyce, the federal ag minister now, who has been aware of this problem, to speed up the processes, the reviews that he's already got underway.
Yes, there is a review on at the moment of how Australia measures its import risks, but I don't think the ginger growers are going to get what they want. The Federal Department of Agriculture is ruling out suspending the imports, saying that the roundworm that was discovered is not a quarantine risk.
Okay. It's not a battle over ginger that's on the lips of the fishing industry in South Australia. They're concerned around marine sanctuary zones that come into effect.
Yeah, today 83 marine sanctuary zones where fishing is banned came into effect in the state's 19 marine parks. It's a pretty big deal for South Australia. But the fishing industry, not just the hobby fishermen, but the commercial fishermen, say the introduction of the sanctuary zones is going to have a huge impact on them. But Butson is from Port Wakefield. He says there's going to be a flow-on effect from the fishing industry to other businesses.
We have guys that deal with the transporting of our fish. They're going to be losing their income. We've got the ice suppliers from Port Pirie. We'll be buying a lot less ice from them, so they'll be affected as well. The flow-on effects go far further than just the fishing families. We are very, very worried, and there is high levels of stress within the community.
The South Australian government does say they will be doing regional impact assessments on the economic effects of these zones around Port Wakefield and also on the far west coast and around Kangaroo Island.
Okay. This is the story we've been waiting for, Tony. Who is Captain Citrus?
Well, the Florida citrus industry, Florida's pretty well known for its citrus, but over the last decade or so, the industry has been in big trouble for two reasons. Insects, a particular aphid, has been knocking the citrus around, and some disease as well. And the industry has been trying to revive itself, partly through the old American technique of advertising. And they had... they did try having a talking orange from outer space to promote the citrus industry, but for some mysterious reason, it didn't catch on. So what they've done now, the Florida Citrus Department, and that shows you how important citrus is to Florida, they actually have a citrus department in the state government, has paid Marvel Comics, which specialises in superheroes, $1 million to create a comic book superhero called Captain Citrus, who works with the Avengers. Now, the Avengers are a group of other superheroes, and one of the things they do is harness sunlight to get rid of their enemies, people who are out to destroy the citrus industry.
Educate kids about photosynthesis while they're at it.
Well, possibly, or maybe just show them some DVDs, because there are DVDs attached to this. It comes in a big package, Captain Citrus. And David Steele from the Citrus Department says the aim is to create loyalty to the state's citrus industry.
We don't anticipate that this initiative is going to sell orange juice tomorrow, so we're more interested with this initiative in building a long-term relationship with these children and their families and strengthening their affinity for Florida citrus and also increasing their awareness of the value of nutrition.
Now, we do have a photo of Captain Citrus on our webpage, abc.net.au/rural. More details of this exciting initiative, but I do feel a bit sorry for the orange from outer space, which has been pushed aside by the superheroes.
By Captain Citrus. He's in good shape.
Yeah.
Yeah. Six-pack. Great hair, though.
He does look like a superhero.
He well and truly does.
It's very much a Marvel Comics creation.
Yeah, I see Captain America in the background there. We've sent him out on Twitter as well, at RNBushTelly.
Yeah, he hangs out with Thor as well, apparently.
Yeah. you can find more at abc.net.au/rural if you are not on Twitter. We haven't found out yet if Angry Orange is it was an initiative of the citrus industry or not. You're listening to Bush Telegraph. You're on RN.
Mental illness. It may affect you or someone important in your life.
There's a fine line between sanity and insanity.
For the first time on Australian television, go inside one of the busiest mental health units in the country.
It's part of our society. We can't ignore it.
Meet patients in times of need and the dedicated medical teams caring for them. A must-see series over 3 nights. Changing Minds, part of Mental As, starts next Tuesday, 8:30 on ABC.
And for Mental As, we'll make sure we focus on mental health initiatives and issues in rural Australia throughout next week on Bush Telegraph. So make sure you tune in then, particularly on next Wednesday when we'll have a special feature program about this and one man's journey, I guess, through his recovery in the Riverina area of New South Wales. So that's coming up next week on Bush Telegraph. I'm Cameron Wilson. You're on RN and Radio Australia. The New South Wales coal seam gas industry has been given a tentative tick of approval by the state's chief scientist. Professor Mary O'Kane was commissioned to review the industry in New South Wales about a year and a half ago by the former Premier Barry O'Farrell. The final report was delivered last night and it says the industry is not significantly more likely to be more damaging or dangerous than other extractive industries. Professor Mary O'Kane joins me now to explain more. Welcome to Bush Telegraph, Professor.
Thank you.
This report, look, it seems to be broken into technical risks and also social challenges. Can we start with the technical risks? How serious are the environmental risks posed by CSG extraction?
Well, there certainly are risks, and there are, as you wonderfully pointed out in that introduction, there are risks in all extractive industries and in other industries. But the technical risks in this area particularly go to managing the produced water and managing the byproducts involved in that, such as salts, also go to appropriate well technologies to be able to have properly lined wells so you don't get damage to aquifers or other areas, and also to making sure you use appropriate chemicals in technologies such as fracking. So there's a range of things here, and of course Australia has a great level of expertise in the extractive industries, but you always need excellent legislation and regulation and government systems, and we propose, as well as the standard sort of government systems, that there should be a major whole of environment data repository for the state where all the data for all environment activities is held and interrogated all the time, and an expert body appointed to look at that and report annually to government on the state of the sedimentary basins from which, of course, we extract our water, coal and coal seam gas.
But is it fair to say that you assess that given the level of technological expertise, the industry does not pose an overwhelming or an unreasonable risk?
Working to appropriate legislative and regulatory requirements, no, it doesn't, as long as you do have these other monitoring and oversight arrangements in place, and as long as you deal with legacy issues such as abandoned wells and inconsistencies in some of the legislative provisions with regard to some other industries.
Okay. You mentioned there that water is a key concern for many communities. It's contamination, but it's also depletion.
Yes.
Do you feel that we know enough about the hydrology at a local level to to make those calls, to be able to say this industry will not damage the resource or contaminate the resource or deplete the resource?
Of course, you can't actually see under the earth, despite, you know, projects like the wonderfully Syro-termed glass earth that was, you know, running through the 90s and 2000. We're understanding more through the power of big data issues. But, of course, we extract enormous amounts of water through for irrigation purposes, so we've been doing that for a long time, and generally the coal seam gas extraction is smaller. I mean, it's who has priority would become a question, and so you're up for land use questions, and, of course, land matters were very considerable. We know a fair amount to work on the aquifers and on how to deal with the produced water, but a lot of it turns on issues like water licensing and so on. And that is something that, of course, this state and other states have very sophisticated systems for, about who can do what with the water that's extracted.
Okay. You've mentioned that part of this debate is around who gets priority, and I see in the report you recommend carefully designating appropriate areas based on land use.
And geological and land use, access
but
matters.
Isn't that where we run into problem? It's defining those areas where the argument's taking place?
Yeah, we do. And we've got to have very clear criteria for doing that and then apply those criteria in a very consistent manner so that everyone can feel, yes, there's a level of trust. Of course, you're never going to have everyone totally happy, as we see in the results of, you know, the response to this review. Mm. But you can have very transparent systems, and you can have fair systems where people not only get a say but get compensated appropriately if they've been impacted by some of the things people fear a lot, such as inappropriate land access or dropping of land values, or, as you pointed out, if they felt water was depleted in various ways. And so that's really important. And I should have mentioned earlier, another important set of recommendations goes to finance issues, that the industry should, through the fees and levies and royalties and taxes, of course, bear the burden of the regulatory system so it's not a burden on the taxpayer. And also that we've recommended that the government look at appropriate insurance issues and environmental fund in case there was any cumulative long-term issues. So it's, as I said, a big package of recommendations.
Yeah, I think there's, 16 in all.
16,
so
that's right.
We'll make sure there's a link up on our website if people want
thank
to,
you, yes.
to see
and
that.
And remember, too, that we released not just the final report last night, but one on compliance systems. And it's not on systems, it's actually looking at the compliance as it's happened and what the results are. And there's one on managing risk, plus a series of information papers on things like abandoned wells, fracking and setbacks.
Okay. It seems to me that the problem, perhaps not you as an individual, but the real problem around this issue is summed up today when I look at the headlines of the two main newspapers in Sydney. The Sydney Morning Herald goes with coal seam gas will have unintended consequences,
yes,
says the chief scientist, whereas the Daily Tally says coal seam gas mining in New South Wales declared manageable by the chief scientist. There's the problem right there, isn't it?
Yeah, I think the Tally possibly was a little closer in to the headline I'd have written for myself. The unintended consequences issue really was a point that is made a couple of times in the report by us, that even in the best systems for all extractive industries, and indeed all industries, you do get unintended consequences. And you just need to be ever vigilant. I was trying to make the point that you can't be Pollyanna-ish about any industry, that the community, government and the industry itself needs to have the very best possible standards, and you need to have industry acting like a responsible industry, and you do need an active, interested community. And that's one of the things I'm, you know, very impressed with in New South Wales. We do have an active, interested community, and people spent a lot of time writing to the review, coming to meetings at our request, responding to comments and questions. And it's very heartening to see this level of interest in the matter.
I guess time will tell if your recommendations, one, are adopted, and two, if they go some way to bring about a less divisive debate.
I hope they do. And can I just take this opportunity to say thank you to all who contributed to the debate and particularly to the review.
And thanks for taking time out to join us today. I appreciate it.
Okay.
Professor Mary O'Kane, who is the New South Wales Chief Scientist. As I said, we'll make sure there is a link up to that full report if it's an issue of interest to you via the Bush Telegraph website later today. Now, let's get some reaction to this from around the state in New South Wales. David Claughton is the executive producer of the Country Hour in New South Wales and has been following this closely. Hi, David.
Hi, Cameron.
Let's start with the farming sector. What have you heard from agricultural communities?
We're not hearing a lot just yet. There's a lot of reaction coming from the industry bodies, from gas companies. We're going to dig in a little bit deeper because, as Mary O'Kane was explaining there, she's put out quite a few information papers that dig into the detail of issues like fracking, like land use and where do you put mining activities, about the whole issue of compliance. And so we will dig into that issue a little bit more deeply in the coming days. We had one farmer who's quite closely associated with one of the opposition groups, because farming and environmentalists are working pretty closely together on this issue, saying that she doesn't believe that the risks to the water resources from one of the company's projects can be managed, and she's urging the state government to step in and stop the exploration. So that's an example of how this report is being read very differently by different groups.
I see Lock the Gate, a group that is opposed to coal seam gas extraction, has come out and read the report one way as well, said quite clearly that it thinks its position's been endorsed by this.
Yeah, they're saying the state government should put a halt to any further consideration of the Narrabri gas project, that's a Santos project, until all the risks identified have been fully researched and they've got multi-year baseline data to be collected. And I think the chief scientist is saying you need the baseline data and you need it all in one place so that you can weigh up the risks of cumulative projects like of many gas wells, which you can see in the US and you see in Queensland where development is much more progressed.
Okay, you said you've heard some response so far from the industry, the resources sector. What have they had to say?
Paul Fennelly from the Australian Petroleum Exploration and Production Association spoke to a few people up in New England where a lot of this activity is being developed. And I think the thing that came up for him was he was tested on the insurance issue, and it's not clear, at least from a surface reading of the report, what Mary O'Kane is suggesting here. You know, is she asking for the companies to cough up some more money as an industry so that when bad things happen, as they do from time to time in many industries, that there will be ways of compensating landholders or people affected? And he says that it's just common practice because companies in New South Wales already put guarantees up and have commitments in terms of their own financial security, and they pay royalties to the New South Wales Treasury. So those sorts of things can be taken out of royalties. And he also, when pushed on this and said, could the industry pay more? He says, well, governments everywhere are pushing more towards a user-pay system, and so if the New South Wales government wants to explore that, you know, we talk about it.
So as we mentioned, there's a handful, or there's more than a handful, there's 16 recommendations here. It's quite detailed. What are you really waiting to hear, or who are you really waiting to hear from in the coming days, David?
Well, I think we need to let everybody digest it a little more. Like Paul Fennelly, for example, was asked whether he would support one of the recommendations around a standing expert advisory body on coal seam gas. And here's what he said.
Well, that's one of the great successes of Queensland. They established a gas fields commission comprising experts from the industry, farming groups, a broad range of people, and they could focus on what are the real issues, what are the real risks. And rather than, you know, focus on the noise emanating from anti-gas groups, really focusing on what are the issues of importance to farmers and communities.
So that's just one thing that she's recommending. And what he's saying, and the industry body is saying generally, is that a lot of these things are already in place. You might remember Mary O'Kane put out an initial report about a year ago. So the industry's already been responding to some of the things that she's been talking about. Other things, I think, will take a long time to kind of work through. We also heard from AGL today. They're a big gas company. They're a retailer as well as an explorer and producer. They've been running a project in Western Sydney for 13 years now, which is very close to urban development. Mm-hmm. And Mary O'Kane points out in some of her interviews that actually that's been running pretty safely for that period of time. So AGL are saying, look, they're pretty comfortable with the report. It supports a safe, regulated development of coal seam gas in New South Wales. And Suzanne Westgate, who's head of land and approval, says there are some things that she's not entirely supportive of. Like she says a lot of work has already been done on regulation in this industry and land access, and they've refined a lot of the regulations. She doesn't want to see them do a complete overhaul of the Act in New South Wales. And the other thing that she was tested on today by some other people in ABC on the Mid-North Coast, she was asked on this issue of segregating areas out, you know, which areas are suitable for coal seam gas and which aren't. And there has been a lot of concern from opponents in the area around the Gloucester Valley around their Walker Valley project. And here's what she said about that particular project and the suitability of that area.
The chief scientist also supports an adaptive management process, which means that you carry out the project and you make sure you're operating with best practice. And if risks are identified, then you make sure you address those risks. The Walkyvory pilot, which has recently been approved, will demonstrate, we think, that the risks from coal seam gas can appropriately be managed in that geology.
So she's saying adaptive management, and another way of expressing that might be suck it and see.
Yeah.
And Mary O'Kane, really, she does support the industry very strongly on this point, saying Australia has a very fine tradition of of taking technology and applying it to new locations and making things work. And our record of accidents, if you like to put it like that, has been very low in comparison to other countries. So she's really supporting the industry to have a go and do it according to the best standards possible.
All right, David, a bit to keep you busy in the coming days. Look forward to hearing more. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Cameron.
David Claughton, who's the executive producer of the ABC's Country Hour in New South Wales. You're listening to Bush Telegraph. We've been looking at conservation all this week, this all in light, or as we hear this report from around the world yesterday, saying there's been a huge decline in species in the last 10 years. So we've been looking at what Australians are doing to try to protect some of our most at-risk species. Today we're looking at the green parrot on Norfolk Island. It's come within a feather of extinction. By some estimates, it's the most threatened bird in the world, or has been at least. It's under attack from cats and rats. Nothing new about that. But it's also got a much more surprising enemy, if you like, the crimson parrot. It's a fairly dire situation on the island, but it's not without help, without hope. Abby Smith is a wildlife ecologist with the Norfolk Island National Park who moved to the island last year just to try and save the species from disappearing altogether. Abby, welcome to the program.
Hi there.
What is it about this parrot that got your attention?
Oh, well, it's just such a beautiful species, and it's an endemic species of Norfolk Island, which means this is the only place in the whole world that this species is found. In Norfolk Island National Park is the only spot where it's breeding. That's about 300 hectares in size, so there's just a tiny population left in a really small spot left on the globe, and it's pretty amazing to have the opportunity to be here and help do something about that.
So that's it, save them in that 300 hectare area or there's no more. What does it look like?
Well, it's a small parakeet, and it's green all over, and it's got sort of blue flashes on the edges of its wings and a red cap on their head. It's closely related to a lot of the New Zealand species that are commonly known as kakarikis. So a lot of people might know them from the pet industry, see a lot of kakarikis in the pet industry, but the Norfolk Island green parrot is a little bit bigger and a different species.
Okay. I mentioned that it was considered to be maybe the most threatened bird in the world. Just how dire did the situation get?
So, look, the bird has suffered reductions in its population many times throughout history since human habitation here on Norfolk. So cats and rats are a big influence on their population, and habitat clearance when people first populated Norfolk Island had a massive impact on their population. We had a survey done from Massey University last year, and they estimated between 46 and 92 birds remaining. But probably the scariest thing was that during that survey, they only managed to confirm 10 adult females left in the population. So that does put them right up there with one of the most endangered birds in the world.
Yeah, okay. So where does that leave you, though? You think you can the population recover from that point?
Well, what we've done in the last year, since we got those very alarming figures, Norfolk Island National Park and our support organisations and partners that we've made along the way have jumped into gear. We've developed an action plan that we've been implementing in the last year. And that action plan involves many different things, but what we've seen from that is that we've had 51 chicks successfully fledged from their nests in the last year, well, less than a year,
mm-hmm.
and of those 51 chicks, 25 of them were females. So
25 new females to a population of 10. That's not a bad result.
That's right. Mm. It's amazing, yeah. So assuming they all survive, we've tripled the population of females in under a year, which is just astounding. And these figures that we're seeing are actually the most productive year for the green parrot since records have been kept from 1985.
Oh, so that's some encouraging news against a backdrop of some really negative news that we've heard this week. It's no mean feat just to get to the hatching stage for these birds, is it?
That's right, yeah. We do quite intensive monitoring of the birds here, and our monitoring program has shown us that we've discovered that chicks have around about a 65% chance of survival once they hatch. So it's during that incubation stage where they're really vulnerable. And when you've got females sitting in the nest, they're really vulnerable to rats climbing into the nest. And rats have been known to not only eat the adult females, but they'll also eat the eggs and any chicks in the nest as well. And this is probably why we're seeing such a sex bias in the population, because females are much more vulnerable while they're sitting in their nest incubating eggs than what males are flying around.
Okay. So there's this danger then that you get rid of the cats and you get more rats?
Well, that's right. So you really need to look at cat and rat control together, and we've been doing that over the last year. We do quite a lot of cat and rat control, and we've also started implementing a crimson rosella control program as well.
Yeah, so what problems do the crimson rosellas cause?
Well, The crimson rosellas are at direct competition with the green parrots. The crimson rosellas are a test species here on Norfolk. They were introduced here, and they'll actually go inside green parrot nests, and we've got some footage of them going inside green parrot nests and then find that the nests have, and the eggs inside the nests have all been smashed up by the crimson rosellas, and they'll take over the nest site.
They're just bullies, are they? They move in and push the green parrot out.
That's right. Well, they're a little bit bigger than the green parrots, and a lot more aggressive. And what we're seeing is that they do better. There's just been some recent information come out as well that they're possibly a little bit better at dealing with some diseases like beak and feather disease. So where the green parrot might suffer from something like that, the crimson rosellas don't, their populations don't appear to be suffering so much. So they're actually exploding, and there's crimson rosellas all over Norfolk Island, and the green parrots, you have to really search to find them.
So is the aim to eradicate the crimson rosella, or just keep the numbers down if you can?
Well, we haven't really gone into that level of planning about crimson rosellas just yet. The National Park just manages a small area on Norfolk Island, and we do our best to try and control the numbers within that area, but it would take a much larger approach across the island and in collaboration with the Norfolk Island government to do something sort of more strategic than that. Mm. We hope that there might be a view to looking at something like that, with a longer term view to dealing with some of these feral pests here on Norfolk into the future.
What would that be, something like an island wide shooting campaign or trapping, or what would it be?
Oh, well, there's probably lots of different techniques that you could use. It would have to be something that we'd investigate further down the track, I think.
How much community support are you getting? I guess there's still people that have affection for cats, and something like the crimson rosella is an attractive bird, isn't it? So there might be some support for it as well. Is the community supportive of your attempts to try to eradicate those, or at least control the numbers of those species in order to save the green parrot?
Well, I think the green parrot here on Norfolk is a really iconic species, and most people in the community certainly love their green parrot, and are on board with trying to help with conservation efforts here as well. It's always going to be a difficult situation when you've got to make the decision between something cute and cuddly like a cat, and people obviously are quite affectionate towards cats as well. So again, I think it's just about talking with the community about these issues and the effects that they're having on such a threatened species and such a special species for Norfolk Island.
So you've had a really successful last year, but I imagine there's still a lot of work to be done. What's the greatest risk that exists now that could suddenly wipe out the green parrot?
Well, the fact that there's only one population of these birds left in the world and they're just found in one very small spot, so it wouldn't take much. Something like a new disease that the population is really susceptible to, or a cyclone, could wipe out the entire population and, you know, we find ourselves with no green parrots left.
Mm.
So it's really important that we look at trying to establish an insurance population of green parrots, and that's something that that we hope to look into in the future. We've actually been talking with the Threatened Species Commissioner about this, and he's really keen to support our work on green parrots. In fact, he's coming to the island next month to have a look at some of the work we've been doing and talk about what comes next for them.
All right. Well, Abby, good luck with it. Good to hear that you've had some significant progress, and all the best with your future efforts.
Thank you. Yeah, look, we have had some great progress, but there's still so much to do. There's so many people have helped with the success, but still a lot of work to do, and we still need more help.
All right. Nice chatting. Thanks, Abby. Abby Smith, who's a wildlife ecologist with Norfolk Island National Parks. The latest in our week-long series of conservation efforts around Australia to try to get a handle on what's working and what's not. We'll make sure we bring you more on that tomorrow. You can also see our earlier stories from the week online. Just go to the RN website. You'll find us under the program's guide. That's Bush Shelley for today. See you at the same time tomorrow. You're on RN.